Medication tips and tricks for the crashing patient.
The bait effect may be doing us more harm than good.
Got a quick EKG that just did not show a good rhythm whatsoever.
Anecdotally, it worked.
Lidocaine is back.
This one came down to ACE inhibitors and lots of bananas.
That just looked bizarre. Well, welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. This month, a very, very special guest, a dear friend, joining us on the podcast. And that is none other than Dr. Brian Hayes. You've heard Brian on many podcasts. It's been actually many, many months since we've gotten him back on CCPEM. He has been quite busy traveling the world, lecturing everywhere, doing some great educational things for both emergency medicine, resuscitation in general, and critical care. Recently, Brian and I had the chance to catch up and do AAEMs, Resuscitation for the Emergency Physician pre-conference to their scientific assembly last month held in Las Vegas. And Brian gave really two outstanding lectures, but one that I thought would be outstanding for the podcast here is his discussion on medication tips and tricks for the crashing patient. So without further ado, Brian, thanks so much for joining us again on the podcast. How are you doing?
Mike, thanks so much for having me. It was really great to get back in touch with you at AAEM, a couple of dinners together. In the last month, it's been pretty exciting. We took the family for a trip to Paris, and we just so happened to visit Notre Dame about an hour or two before the fire started. That is in no way an implication of us being involved, but it was so overwhelming to be there with my kids and my wife and to take that all in and then get back to our Airbnb apartment and kind of see that all over the news. And it was really emotional to be there, but otherwise a great, great trip and just really unbelievable. But it's been a good month, so I was really glad to catch up with you at AAM.
That's good to hear. And in terms of that trip, we were watching it around the world, you know, on TV, and you're sitting there and had just seen it right before it caught on fire, and then we're watching it live in person in front of you. I can't imagine what that was like with all of the Parisians around it. You could see just the anguish in terms of that historic cathedral going up in flames.
Yeah, it was just such an emotional nationwide response. It's just so near and dear to their hearts there in that country and just a symbol for them. And it was really incredible to be there while that was going on. Best wishes to them.
I know there's been a lot of discussion about trying to rebuild, and I'm sure a lot of folks have contributed quite a bit of funds, and hopefully it will be rebuilt because it was an amazing, amazing landmark and big piece of Paris.
Absolutely.
Well, let's get over to some education here on the podcast. Let's get to the topic that I introduced just a few minutes ago, the medication tips and tricks for the crashing patient. So for those of you listening, this is going to be a lot of just awesome quick hit pearls and potential pitfalls as Brian goes through a few cases. Now, Brian, in terms of case number one, topic number one, we treat patients, cardiac arrest, moribund, crashing patients on a daily basis, and often it tends to get back to cardiovascular disease, arrhythmias, and the one that we can intervene on is that VTAC that may, hopefully, we prevent it from going into V-fib or pulsus VTAC. But you've got some pearls or medication tips and tricks for things to treat ventricular arrhythmias. So let's delve into topic one, and I'll let you take it away.
Sure. There's two tips here, and one you may be a little familiar with because it's been around for 2 or 3 years, and the other one may be not so familiar to you because it just came out at the end of 2018. So we will start with that one first, and we know that typically the AHA releases their adult cardiac arrest algorithm every 5 years, and so last one was 2015, next one is due in 2020. Usually in between those 5 years, though, there's really not a lot that comes out from them, but what they decided to start doing recently is release, as new data becomes available, to release smaller updates. And so one of their focused updates came out at the very end of 2018. And what it talked about was bringing back lidocaine, yes, lidocaine, for VFib and pulseless VTAC. And so what they now recommend is an equal level of evidence to amiodarone for use in these cases. Now, they do acknowledge still that antidysrhythmic medications are unlikely to cardiovert patients from VF or pulsus VTAC into normal sinus rhythm. But if you're not an amiodarone kind of person, then lidocaine is equally and weekly, but equally recommended to amiodarone, so lidocaine. And all you need to do is probably in your code cart. The dose is one syringe usually, which is 100 milligrams for most patients. And there you have it.
So pearl number one, lidocaine is back. I guess for those who haven't used it, well, lidocaine's here.
Lidocaine, I'm not going to get too much into the details, but you may not have used it a lot. And so lidocaine has a little bit less side effects than amiodarone, especially in the long term. So this might be something that you can use in the ED, hopefully, to cardiovert your patient out of the rhythm and then go from there.
All right. Outstanding pearl number one. You mentioned there was two pearls here. What's the second?
The other one is we occasionally get these cases of refractory VFib, and sometimes, you know, you follow the algorithm, you've given the epinephrine, you've shocked the patient, you might even be doing the dual defibrillation, and it's still not working. And there's been two small studies that came out, one in 2014, one in 2016. And when I say small, we're talking on the order of 20 to 30 patients per study. And what they both looked at is using esmolol in these cases of refractory VFib. And I've had a chance to do this once or twice, and anecdotally it worked. But both of these studies were looked at using that. And the thought here is that, you know, we're giving epinephrine, the patient has a lot of sympathomimetic stuff going on, and there's a lot of epinephrine, norepinephrine in the body during these times. And so the beta effects may not actually be what we're looking for. We really want some good alpha effects, constriction from those catecholamines, and the beta effect may be doing us more harm than good. And so the thought here is that if we can give a beta 1 selective antagonist like esmolol, then maybe we can still get the benefits of the alpha agonism without the deleterious effects of the beta. And in both of these studies, again, small numbers, there was more return of spontaneous circulation and more discharge with favorable neurologic outcome when you used esmolol in these refractory cases. And how do we get there? Well, the patients that they included had more than 3 defibrillations and at least 3 milligrams of epinephrine and has gotten 300 milligrams of amiodarone. So this is not first line. This is after you've tried the first line or two of therapy. That's when you can start thinking about esmolol.
Okay. I was just going to follow up with that question, so I'm glad you mentioned that. So in terms of this critical illness state, we're talking about ventricular arrhythmias. We got a nice pearl for lidocaine and now follow-up pearl for esmolol. Outstanding. Anything before we leave topic one?
No, those are the two that we talked about at AAEM and the ones that we are hoping to share with the CCPEM audience today.
All right. Well, let's move on to another topic. Let me tell you about a case that I had last week before heading out for another conference. This was a 51-year-old female who came in altered, obtunded, really decreased mental status, and medics radioed in that the blood pressure was pretty low, about 80s over 50, but bradycardic as well in the 50s to 60s. They reported that the patient had called for nausea, vomiting, just wasn't feeling well. And when they rolled in, we began that our primary and secondary survey, and immediately we saw the AV fistula in the left upper extremity. Got a quick EKG that just did not show a good rhythm whatsoever. It was a wide complex ventricular rhythm that just looked bizarre, and we were very, very concerned about hyperkalemia as an etiology of the patient's cardiovascular instability. And so then we started down the hyperkalemia treatment with calcium and then also insulin D50. A whole additional stuff went on in terms of the patient's resuscitation. But I would say maybe 30 to 45 minutes after we administered that, the patient then had a generalized seizure. And then we determined that that seizure was in fact due to a glucose of just 23. And I envision you have a pearl or a pitfall in this type of case.
Yeah, you pretty much outlined the exact case that's really bothered me since I started in emergency medicine. And I will never forget, I don't think I was working with you that day, but it was at Maryland where I saw the sickest hyperkalemia patient I had ever seen, very similar to what you're describing. Interestingly, this one came down to ACE inhibitors and lots of bananas from what the patient told us, but it was the classic bradycardia turning into a sine wave, patient going unresponsive, and I'll never forget that case. But the pearl we want to talk about today is one of the primary treatments that we have, at least temporizing, is insulin. And insulin works by temporarily shifting the potassium intracellularly. It lasts for a few hours, and hopefully that few hours is enough time for us to get more definitive therapy at removing the potassium, such as hemodialysis. The problem here is that when you give IV insulin, it works pretty quick. You usually start to see an effect within about 5 to 10 minutes. It peaks in about 30 minutes, and then it lasts for a good 2 to 3 hours. But if you have a patient that is normoglycemic to begin with, so their glucose is 100, 120, so 10 units is the dose that most clinicians choose to give, that can drop your glucose level pretty significantly. And so if you're normoglycemic to begin with, you can anticipate that you're going to get hypoglycemic after that insulin if you don't supplement their glucose enough. And the problem here is that when you give glucose, even if you do give it up front, which we do in most cases, it only lasts for about 60 minutes. And so you have a period from about 60 minutes to about 120 or 180 minutes where you have insulin around, but not dextrose. And if you look at all of the studies that report on hypoglycemia, anywhere between 10 and 20% is the number that they quote in terms of patients who get hypoglycemic, and they generally get hypoglycemic anywhere between 45 minutes and an hour or slightly thereafter. So it makes perfect sense with the kinetics of the drug. And so we have a couple of ways that we can combat this. One is you can front load the patient with glucose, and that's all well and good. Temporary hyperglycemia is probably not a bad thing in these cases. But again, the glucose only lasts about 60 minutes. And so the key trick here to make sure you avoid the hypoglycemia is to have a protocol in place that allows your nurse to get a finger stick 30 and 60 minutes after that initial insulin dose. And that way, when you've treated the patient and you're on seeing the next one or the next one and the next one, then you know that someone's going to be monitoring that glucose level so that what you described, where your patient is seizing from hypoglycemia, hopefully will be caught early and you can have a PRN glucose order in there already and have the nurse be able to give that without you having to worry about it.
Great, great pearl. Now, let me just ask you another question, and a great pearl that you also brought up when we were doing the Resus pre-conference course. This person comes in, they're altered, they're hypotensive, they're bradycardic. You know, we're thinking about a lot of things, and as it turned out with both of our particular patients, it was severe hyperkalemia. But often, you know, we both practice an environment with opioid overdoses, where we are providing naloxone and reversal agents. Any pearls on that?
Yeah, this one has actually got even trickier, I would say, in the last couple of years. The pearl that I gave is that some patients, when they come in, if they look like an opioid overdose, you're going to give them naloxone. And the question always is how much naloxone to give. Now, this is where it gets tricky. So the pearl that I gave was about giving low dose naloxone. So this pearl that we're going to talk about is not for the patient who is apneic or arresting from hypercarbia. That's not who we're talking about here. This is the patient that you suspect an opioid overdose. They may be breathing at 4, 6, 8 a minute. Their O2 sats are a little low. And you want to sort of prove to yourself that this is the diagnosis and reverse it so that your patient is breathing on their own, but not so much as to put them into withdrawal. That's kind of the patient that we're talking about here. Because what you see is the EMS and the pre-hospital protocols, a lot of them will give 2 or 4 milligrams up front. Now, in 2019, where fentanyl is everywhere, that's probably reasonable because you may need more to reverse those types of opioids. But for the classic heroin overdose, you don't need 2 milligrams. And so that amount will usually put the patient in withdrawal. And so by the time you get them in the hospital, they're thrashing about, they're agitated, they're hurting others, including themselves and staff, they're vomiting, bad situation. And so what you can do is you take a vial of naloxone, which is 0.4 milligrams per ml. And what I do is I take that, it's 1 ml. So you take that 1 ml and you dilute it with 9 mls of saline and a 10 ml syringe. Perfect math. And you've diluted it by tenfold. So now instead of 0.4 milligrams per ml, you actually have 0.04 milligrams per ml. And then what you do is you give the patient 1 or 2 mls IV, wait 30 seconds. That may be enough to kind of get them reversed, but not into withdrawal. Or you might have to give a little bit more, and that's okay. And the reason that this is nice is that it avoids that withdrawal that you typically see when you give too much. And if you need to give an infusion because they keep recrudescing, maybe it's methadone or some other longer acting drug, then you have a much better idea of what the true starting rate of that naloxone infusion will be, because you know what the actual wake up dose was, as opposed to just saying, oh, it was 4 milligrams to wake them up. Like, of course, 4 milligrams is going to wake most patients up. But what's the true number? That's what this strategy helps you to get. But again, remember that in this day and age, you may try that quickly. And if it's not working, you jump right to the higher doses. And that's totally fine.
All right. Awesome, awesome, Pearl. So we've covered some ventricular arrhythmias. We've talked about some hyperkalemia, potentially life-threatening hypoglycemia in giving insulin. A naloxone, Pearl. Another topic that you talked about that I think definitely is critically important is the dosing of TPA. It is certainly a medication that many emergency providers are used to in the setting of acute ischemic stroke, a little less often for massive PEs and other indications. So go through your pearls on TPA.
Sure. This one applies really to cardiac arrest dosing of TPA. And so that could be from a PE, it could be from an ACS case, probably not from a stroke necessarily. So usually you're looking at those first two, or you could have an undifferentiated case of cardiac arrest in front of you. And if you're going to give TPA, here's some pearls. The first one is that give it early. If you really think that the patient has something that can be reversed by TPA, give it early. And the best evidence is in PE. So if you have a patient where they either were at a high risk for PE, or it's someone that was in your ED and you were suspecting PE was the cause and then they have a cardiac arrest, that would be a patient where TPA might be a good choice to give early in that cardiac arrest resuscitation. If you have an undifferentiated case in front of you, though, there is no evidence to support giving TPA. So it is not likely to reverse their cardiac arrest, and it's probably not going to be worth the money and all the other investment that you're going to be putting into that. So PE, yes. ACS, yes. Undifferentiated, no. But the real question is, what the heck dose do I give? So if I have this patient in front of me, how much do I give? And again, the literature is sort of all over the place here. But if you really boil it down, the real dose is 50 or 100 milligrams as a bolus. So what I usually do, and this seems to be most supported by the data, is you give 50 milligrams right up front. You continue CPR for at least a good 10 to 15 minutes to make sure you get good circulation of the drug. And you can always repeat the other 50 milligrams in 10 or 15 minutes if you need to. So that's the strategy that I use that's best supported by the data, is 50 up front. You can repeat 50 again if you need to.
Outstanding. I love it. You've given us so much information already, Brian. I'm going to ask you maybe to do one more topic if you're up for it.
Yeah, of course.
All right. Well, we have gotten a lot of questions in from our listeners on the topic of TXA, and it just so happens that you covered that in the last few minutes of your medication tips and tricks discussion. Thought it was great. So can you go through a few pearls and maybe some pitfalls on TXA?
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't have time to cover all of the stuff that we talked about at the conference. And so if you want to read a little bit more about this, I have the handout to my talk on my site, farmertoxguide.com, under the lectures and handouts section. Just click on the link for the AAM talks, and all the links to the references we're going to talk about are there, and it'll bring you right to the PubMed citation. So if you want to do a little bit further reading, you can. So just very briefly, TXA in trauma, a pretty good amount of studies with them. The main one that started a lot of what we talk about today came back in 2010 called CRASH II. I'm sure you're familiar with that trial. And it looked at over 20,000 patients that were randomized basically to receive TXA or placebo. And it looked at all-cause mortality. It looked at risk of death due to bleeding. And this is in trauma patients. And what they found is, if you look strictly at mortality, there was an absolute risk reduction of 1.5% with a number needed to treat of 67, which is a pretty good number. And the risk of death due to bleeding was significantly reduced with TXA as well, with a number needed to treat of 125. Now, those numbers look great. You think, oh, TXA, it's relatively cheap. It's available. Good numbers. There didn't seem to be an increased risk in clotting. Sounds great. Well, then why haven't we adapted it in all of our trauma bleeding cases in the U.S.? I talked to people in other parts of the world, and they are asking us that question, like, why aren't you using it more in the U.S.? And when I talk to the trauma surgeons where I've worked, they just don't believe that the data from the CRASH II trial matches the populations that we see in the U.S. So again, we don't have time to talk today about all the different criticisms of that trial, but I do want to point out a couple of other studies just to kind of help shape the picture a little bit more. There was a sub-analysis of CRASH II that came out the following year in 2011, and they looked at the time to treatment. So did you benefit if you got TXA earlier after your trauma? And they did find that if you got it before an hour after the injury, then you had a significantly reduced risk of death due to bleeding. And so if you're going to give it, early is key. So I would say less than 1 hour. The study looked up to three. So if you're within three, maybe, but definitely within an hour would be the way to go. The other two studies I just wanted to briefly mention are the MATTERS trial. There's MATTERS and then there's MATTERS 2. And those were looking at patients a little bit more like we might see in a busy trauma center in the US. And these were military patients in Afghanistan. And they also found that even despite being more severely injured, that the TXA groups had a lower mortality than those who did not get TXA. And so the way that this has sort of played out in my practice is I have TXA available when we have a trauma bleeding patient coming in, and I offer it. And I say, hey, I have the TXA ready. Some of the surgeons are on board with it. And some of them say, no, we're good. Let's just use our blood and our other resuscitation techniques. And so I kind of have it ready. And I think we're still waiting for a trial in the US patient population. Even though CRASH-2 had patients from countries that have similar systems to ours, not all of them were. And then there's also some pre-hospital work going on coming out of Australia. They have the patch trial, even though there's already a patch trial looking at platelets, but another patch trial is also underway looking at pre-hospital administration. So we'll have to see where the future goes right now. But I would say that if you're going to use TXA, you're looking at adult trauma patients with severe hemorrhagic shock, so an SBP less than 90, who are at risk for bleeding. So basically, I'm thinking if you're patient is hypotensive, you think they're bleeding, you're activating your massive transfusion protocol, and it's been less than 3 hours since the time of injury, then I would say those are the patients that we should be targeting to get TXA.
Outstanding. And the dose?
The dose is easy, actually. It's 1 gram as a bolus over 10 minutes. The CRASH-2 trial followed that up with a second gram over 8 hours. But I've listened to a couple of commentaries from the authors, and they believe that if you're going to do it, at least get that first gram in. And so from the ED standpoint, that's easy. We can do that. We can give the 1 gram bolus, and then if they want to use it in the OR or afterwards, they can start that second infusion over 8 hours.
All right. Well, aside from trauma, I think 2018 saw a few other articles on TXA. My recollection is one for hemoptysis and then one in the setting of postpartum hemorrhage. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'll just mention the hemoptysis one briefly because that one really caught my attention. Up until the trial in 2018, there were 12 case reports of using nebulized TXA reported. And then there was a randomized trial that looked at about 50 patients. And that's the biggest trial we have right now. But they really did find that it helped reduce blood volume loss. It helped reduce the hemoptysis altogether. And patients had a shorter length of stay. And there were a lot of benefits to using inhaled TXA in these acute stable hemoptysis cases. So I'm kind of starting to think of TXA sort of like we like to use ketamine and magnesium. They kind of have a lot of potential uses. TXA might be another one of those to make sure you stock it in your ED and you have it available for trauma. You have it available for hemoptysis. And we even use it for epistaxis in our ED as well, which we did at Maryland also when I was there. So a couple of uses where you might use TXA. And then you mentioned the last one where you may actually start to see it being used a little bit more in postpartum hemorrhage too, based on the woman trial that came out at the end of 2017.
Outstanding. Well, we're going to start to wind down our discussion together, Brian. But before we do, maybe you've dropped so many pearls. Maybe just go back and hit the key take-home ones as we wrap up our discussion.
Absolutely. So for VFib and pulseless VTach, remember lidocaine is an option once again. And if you have refractory case, think of Esmolol. When you're treating hyperkalemia with insulin, make sure that you plan for supplemental glucose and finger sticks when you're moving on to your next case so that your patient does not get hypoglycemic. For naloxone, if you have that case, try and start with low doses. You may prevent withdrawal and better get an idea of what your starting rate for an infusion might be if you need it. However, not to be used in your apneic cases or respiratory arrest cases or where you are in a community with a lot of fentanyl. You might need higher doses there. For cardiac arrest dosing of TPA, PE, best evidence in terms of indication, dose is 50 milligrams as a push, and you can repeat that with 50 milligrams more in 10 to 15 minutes. And then TXA for trauma. If you have a patient with trauma, with hemorrhagic shock where you're activating your massive transfusion protocol and it's been less than 3 hours since the time of injury, those are the cases where you would consider using it. And the dose is 1 gram to be given over 10 minutes upfront.
Outstanding. So well done, Brian. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. If any of you have questions for Brian, please shoot us an email. I'll get it over to him for a response. And for some reason, if you're not following Brian on Twitter, please be sure to follow him. He's at FarmERToxGuy. And as I led off our introduction with Brian at the beginning of this podcast, he's all over the place in terms of upcoming conferences. And you will be at ASEP this year, won't you?
Yeah, it was great. I got an invitation to give 3 talks this year at ASEP, so I will be there, and I'm looking forward. It's 3 really good talks. They actually picked some good topics this year for me, so I'm really excited about it.
Outstanding. Well, thanks so much for joining us here on the podcast. So thankful to get you back on, and we will look forward to talking with you on an upcoming podcast. My thanks, Brian.
Awesome. Thank you, Mike. Have a great night.
You too. And once again, this is Mike Winters for Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Looking forward to talking with you all on our next podcast. Bye for now.